Accession number 14834, Real One.
Mr. Andrew, Real One, whereabouts were you born, please?
At Elsham in Lincolnshire, as it was then. It's now South Humberside. But...
And which year was this?
1923.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a gamekeeper for the early part of his life, and then he became a farmer later on.
Were you educated at Elsham?
Yes, initially, and then I went to the Catholic school in Brigg, although we weren't Catholics, and then Brigg Grammar School.
And you were at the grammar school when war broke out?
No, I'd left. I'd just left.
What was your reaction when you heard the news that we were at war with Germany?
Well, mixed reaction. I think we really all expected to be bombed immediately, but of course it didn't happen.
Were you dismayed in any way, or excited, or what?
A bit of both, I suppose.
What job did you then take up?
I went, first of all, into a garage as an apprentice. And then I volunteered for the RAF, and I was sent back on 6 months deferred service. So I went to work for Fairfield Engineering Company from Swansea, who were building the hangars at Elsham World Bomber Station.
So you were working in Lincolnshire?
Yes. Mm.
Were you in any of the early bombing by the German Air Force?
No, of course we got three bombs on the farm where I lived, but apart from blowing the windows in, it didn't do any harm to anyone. They were a long way away, but we blast blew the windows in. We killed a couple of sheep, I remember.
Now, can you tell me how you came to be recruited to one of the auxiliary units, please?
Well, yes, I saw my father acting rather strangely and with a uniform on, and I knew he had nothing to do with the Home Guard, at least I didn't think he had. And I got rather too inquisitive, and he took this up with the regular captain who was training them, and the only logical thing they could do was to let me join, although I was only about, well, under 17. This was before I went to work... with Fairfield Engineering, of course. This was in 1940.
Do you remember the month?
No, I can't.
Was it in the summer?
I would think late summer. Because we did exercises at night, and of course it was double British summer time then, so it must have been autumn, I think. And we did exercises against the RAF. We raided them one night at Curtin in Lindsay. They got Spitfires, and I put chalk marks on various Spitfires and then tried to get in the hangar, but I got caught, and they treated me rather roughly and put me in the guard room until the exercise was over.
In what way did they treat you roughly?
Well, I was young and silly and I fought back.
How did you actually join the unit? Was there any formality to it?
Only signing the Official Secrets Act. That's the only formality I knew. Nothing was committed to paper, you see.
Where did this signing of the Official Secrets Act take place?
Well, I think my father just got the forms from the regular officer, and when I was at home, he got me to sign it. It was as simple as that.
What was your address at that time?
Grange Farm, Barton on Humber.
Did your father tell you how he had come to be recruited?
No, I don't think I ever knew that. He was a sniper in the First World War. Whether there'd be any record of that, or I think it's word of mouth, really, among the local, the other people who had been contacted.
And who was the man in charge of the unit?
My father. Do you mean the regular officer?
Yes.
He was an intelligence officer of the Leicestershire Regiment. The first one was a chap called Captain Butler Henderson. And then we got Captain Lamb, who was in charge when I was in it. And then Captain Hamilton Hill. And they went off to, and came back from at intervals, to Yugoslavia among the partisans. They dropped them in and fetched them out at intervals. They seemed to come to us for a rest sort of thing, to, you know, to train us in the sort of rest period. But they'd all been out there to Yugoslavia.
And when your unit was formed in the late summer of 1940, how many were in it?
There were always six. I tried to get six, but I think we had seven. Do you want the names? My father was the patrol leader. His name was Jack Andrew. And then my uncle, Godfrey. Fred Bingley, a butcher. Harold Graves, and he was a ministry butcher, worked for the ministry. And Harry Rushbrook, who was a dairyman, and Val Nettleton, farmer, and myself. I think they were up to strength before I sort of had to be taken in, you know, because of getting a bit nosy about it.
Did the unit have a particular name?
Yes, it was called Sugarloaf Patrol.
And what kind of equipment did you have?
Well, we started out with a Tommy gun. And it was it was like a sporting gun in beautiful blue steel, not at all like the later self-coloured things, you know, that the regular forces got. But this was in a beautiful case, really. It was as though it had been made for sale, you know, to catch a market sort of thing. And it had a 50-round magazine drum, and then a straight 20-round drum with it. So you had 70 rounds of ammunition already loaded into the two containers. That was the Tommy gun. Then we had sticky bombs. They were like looked as though they were covered with molasses. They were a round grenade. The ordinary Mills bomb. And then, of course, we had a pistol, we had a Smith & Wesson, and my father had a Beretta for some reason. Of course, we'd quite a lot of ammunition for all of them. And at one time, we had a Browning, a very old Browning automatic rifle, a real heavy thing, looked like an anti-tank rifle, but it was only a .3 caliber. And then, of course, we had all the sabotage equipment, like the blasting gel ignite, detonators, various types of fuses at different speeds of burn. And then we've got time pencils for delayed action, booby traps for putting under, say, drums of petrol and things like that.
What did the booby traps consist of?
Well, the booby trap's like a matchbox. It's metal, looks more like a Swan Vestas matchbox in size. And when you pulled a pin out, it made it live, and you walked away from it. After attaching the length of fuse to an explosive charge, you walked away from it. And the fellow picked the drum of petrol or whatever up, but he got blown up.
So when you first joined, what did they say to you about the role of the unit, what it was supposed to do?
It was to create as much havoc as possible behind the German lines after they'd passed over. And for that reason, we had the base underground hideout to go down.
Can you describe the base that you had? You told me earlier, but it was
yes. Well, you went along this hedge side, and if you didn't know it was there, you would never find it. And you took with you a long T-handle, and you put it through the ground in a certain spot, turned the lever, and the lid then dropped down till it was horizontal, because it was at an angle before. And then you could slide the whole thing with a lump of grass and whatever in the lid. You could slide it under the hedge out of the way and then go down this shaft about 10 feet deep.
And where was it located?
It was on the farm, down a hedgerow, on out in open country, actually.
When had that been built?
That was built, I think, late in 19... No, it must have been built... It must have been built in spring of 1940 or a little later, maybe summer of 40.
Had you been aware of it being built?
Well, no, not really. What they did, they dug the thing out, and of course it was solid chalk up there. And to hide any, they did it all in a day, and they spread the chalk around the field to look as though it had been limed, so that it wasn't an obvious building work or anything like that. It was camouflaged merely by spreading it all over the field.
So, what was the function of the base? How were you supposed to use it?
Well, it had four bunks in, and the off-watch people were supposed to be asleep in the bunks or laid in them. You got to anyway, because there wasn't room otherwise. And the other two would be supposed to be on watch, or the other three in our case. You went down there during the day and came out at night to do the job.
What did being on watch consist of?
Well, not talking, unfortunately, or having a radio or anything like that, because it was quite possible that dogs would have heard, you know, a radio or anything like that and started scratching at the entrance or something like that. So you've got to keep as quiet as possible. And to throw dogs off the scent, we had I can't remember what it was for, whether it was rat poison or what, but they called it rodine. And it came in tins, it was a liquid. And you spread that down the hedge to throw dogs off scent. Over a fairly wide area sort of thing, so that the dogs would be put off by this and wouldn't smell the human beings. There was a ventilator shaft in the... All it was a glazed earthenware pipe in the bottom of the hedge. That's the only ventilation we had. I think a 6-inch pipe.
What kind of training and exercises did you have?
We trained pretty hard. We every available moment, practically. Of course, we had civilian jobs as well, but we took it very seriously at the time. And the army came to train us, you know, the regular people who were allocated with this army captain, he had a sergeant and 12 men, and they came and trained us in unarmed combat and how to handle explosives and normal shooting with revolver and rifle and so on, you know.
What type of things did you have to learn in unarmed combat?
Well, it's a long time ago now, but I remember one instruction was, if you tackle a man from behind, we had these commando knives with a 6-inch blade, and if you tackled a man from behind, if you got your fingers over a gentleman's helmet at the front and pulled it back, his chin strap would choke him and you could hold him while you put the knife in from behind. Whereas with a British Tommy, you'd probably have got it as they did, over the fore part of the helmet and not under his chin, because it was uncomfortable. But apparently the Germans did actually wear them all the time, or so they said. But we learnt to... it was a sort of form of wrestling, I suppose, but how to overpower a man bigger than yourself. We were taught the techniques. But I wouldn't like to do it today.
Any other methods of killing people that you learned with your bare hands?
Well, yes, there was, I think they call it the AP, AP something or other, and it was essentially a rifle bullet pointing upwards and in a container, and it pushed it into the ground. You pushed it into the ground, and then if you touched this pressure pad, the bullet fired like a rifle and went through your foot and probably through your head even, you know, whatever. Depending what attitude you were, if you were bending forward or maybe go through your chin sort of thing. That was one thing. And then, of course, we were issued with piano wire to put across a road for motorcycle troops.
What if you were caught? Were you given any
instructions? Well, we were told at the time that there'd be no chance. If they found you in the dugout, if they didn't want to question you, they would throw a grenade in, obviously. If they wanted you for interrogation, that would be worse, because you'd get tortured and killed anyway, so there would have been no chance, would there, sort of thing.
Would you have had any insignia or uniform?
Yes, we had all we had was a battle dress. That's when I was in. A battle dress with a Lincolnshire Regiment cap badge. And that's all. Flat caps, I think we had, forage caps.
What were you supposed to tell them if you were caught?
Well, they were part of the Home Guard, I suppose. That would have been the most likely thing, wouldn't it? You couldn't really say you were a professional soldier because they could probably prove that you weren't by just questioning you even, you know, they were questioning you. No, I think if you'd been caught, you wouldn't have had much chance.
Was there any connection between these auxiliary units and the Home Guard?
Not at that time, none at all. Because I think it was in 1944 when they issued Home Guard armbands, but that was after the danger was virtually over. But up to that time, there was no mention of Home Guard. We were auxiliary units. Everything came addressed to auxiliary units. And it had a military intelligence. I think it was MI6. It would be MI6. I think it was MI6. It said on some of the labels that came. You know, when we got equipment and things like that. Auxiliary units and then brackets MI6 or something like that. I seem to remember, well, I'm sure I've seen that on some of the addresses. But of course, it's a long time ago.
Was the term auxiliary units used at the time?
Yes, oh yes. Oh yeah.
If you had been caught and tortured for information, what could you have told them about the high structure?
Nothing, really, nothing. We didn't even know. We obviously knew some of the men who were in it locally. There was another patrol at a little village called Bombay. And another one at Whirlaby, two villages further on from there. And we knew the people from Bombay, but we didn't know the people from Whirlaby. But we never, and we made a point of never going to their hideout and never knowing where it was. So we couldn't have helped them. It would have stopped at us, I think. All we knew was the name of the regular officer who was training us. And he came and went, and whether my father could contact him, I don't know. But everything was done to try and avoid that happening, being questioned and giving the game away, right?
He was known to you by his proper name or a code name?
Oh, the officer. Oh, his proper name. Well, yes, his proper name. As a matter of interest, Anthony Quayle, the actor, was one. And he did it for real. He went out to Yugoslavia.
Did you meet him?
No, I never met him, no.
How did you feel about being a member of this unit?
Well, I really wanted to do something. I intended to take part in it. I thought it was, you know, I thought I ought to, sort of thing. My father had before me But I fancied the RAF, and that's where I eventually went, you see.
Did you ever tell anybody else that you were in such an
underground
unit?
No.
Did you really think that the Germans would invade or not?
Well, in 1940, I think a lot of people thought they would come. I'm sure we did. We thought it would happen. We didn't know how successful they would be, but we thought they would at least try.
How long were you in it for?
Well, I was in it until 1942, when I joined the RAF. I joined in February, but they didn't call me till September. I came on reserve, on deferred service, because you've got to wait for courses, you see. I joined as a pilot, and then transferred to flight engineer in 1943.
But as time went on into 41 and 42, I suppose you must have thought that it had now become...
Oh, yes, I don't think anybody expected it after 43. No, I don't think so. In fact, they stood down in 44, didn't they?
Now, can we go on to you joining the RAF and the training that you had, please?
Well, I joined the RAF, first of all, as a pilot, and I went, first of all, to ACRC, which was St John's Wood in London. It was a block of flats. And then I was sent to Brighton, and I was in the Grand Hotel where Maggie Thatcher was bombed, probably on the same floor. Well, I'm sure I was on the same floor, maybe even the same room. Certainly in the same wing. And we did parade training and that kind of thing, and signals and so on. I remember one day they had French Canadian gunners on the front, and one day they started firing, so we looked out, and there coming straight at us was a Messerschmitt, and he climbed over the hotel, closely followed by a Spitfire, and that's the last we saw of him. But someone, with it being a training establishment, I suppose, to boost morale, they sent an officer around to tell us it had been shot down later in the day. We were doing signals at the time. We were working on Morse buzzers in this room. And then I went to Torquay, to the initial training wing, and I didn't quite make enough marks on the navigation, and the CO sent for me, and he said, well, the normal practice is that you can do it again. You can join a course that's nearly a week or two to finish, sort of thing. You can join them and then do another 2 or 3 weeks and brush up, and you'll get through all right, no doubt. But he said, what I'm going to ask you is, will you be prepared to go for a flight engineer? And we'd never heard of flight engineers. And he explained that that the new Lancasters and the Stirlings and the Halifaxes all carried engineers, as did some of the flying boats. And they were having to take trained fitters off the squadrons to go as flight engineers. And they could ill afford to lose them, and they needed desperately to train some flight engineers, because they were expecting big quantities of these bombers to be built fairly soon. And so I put on my documents that if I did that, I could go back onto pilot training after I'd done a tour of operations on Lancasters. And so I agreed to transfer. I wasn't made to, I was asked politely if I would. Because I'd worked in a garage. I was the only one on the course that he could say had some engineering experience, or little though it was. And he thought I'd be more adaptable, you see. So I went for flight engineer, and I went to St Athan in Wales, and qualified there, and then to RAF Scampton.
What kind of jobs would a flight engineer have to do in a LANC?
Well, you're responsible really for checking over that it's all right. I used to go down and check the engine, run the engines up with the ground crew, stay with them in the mornings sometimes, run the engines up. I would always check the fuel load, and the armament had nothing to do with me. I had nothing at all to do with that. But I checked every other system, you know, oxygen, everything. Not radios either. There's nothing to do with radios. And And then when we came to fly, well, of course, I got to keep a tight calculation on the fuel. And then on takeoff, of course, the pilot leveled the aircraft up down the runway until he got control with his rudders. And all the time he's pushing the four throttles open. And, of course, they needed to be open as soon as possible, as far as possible. So I followed up behind him, and as he took his hand off, I pushed the throttle slowly right forward, you see. And then I went back to my panel and watched. For instance, if a ref counter had dropped slightly and then picked up again, it would have meant the engine had gone. Because it would have, if the engine had cut, then it would have started to windmill and it would have come back to its revs again, even though it wasn't running, because the constant speed propeller would have caused that by coarsening the blade, you see. In flight, I used to monitor the fuel. I was always prepared to go down to the front guns when the bomb aimer was over the target, but it never happened. When we were over the target, you see, the bomb aimer was laid prone,